optimal minimalism.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
Lee Tim Ferriss Show.
This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food-sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multimineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I miss anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS.
The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's WORKLAB, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, boys and girls. This is Tim Ferriss, and welcome to another episode of The Tim Ferriss Show, where it is my job to deconstruct world-class performers of all different types to tease out the habits, routines, tactics, coping mechanisms, favorite books, whatever that you can apply and test in your own life. This episode features one of my favorite comedians of all time, and he's a young feller, Jerrod Carmichael. On Twitter, you can say hello at NotoriousROD. He is pushing the boundaries of comedy with his groundbreaking work in stand-up, television, and film. Now, he is just 29 years old. And what this North Carolina native has accomplished in that short period of time is mind-boggling to me. And I know a lot of productive people. We get into his work process. We talk about how he gets so much done. And if you visit him on social media right now, he has 0 posts on Twitter, on Instagram, at Jerrod Carmichael. And 2017 is going to be his biggest year yet. So we do talk about focus and how he went from East Coast to West Coast and got all of this done. Jerrod stars in the hit NBC series, The Carmichael Show, which he also writes and executive produces. The 3rd season of that show is premiering this year in 2017. In March of 2017, this year, Jerrod will star in his 2nd stand-up comedy special on HBO, directed by Bo Burnham. He made his debut on HBO in 2014 with his critically acclaimed 1-hour special, Love at the Store, directed by Spike Lee. So Love at the Store, this is a name I want you to remember. You have to watch this. It is arguably the funniest stand-up special I've seen in many, many years. And it's the reason that I initially reached out to have Jerrod on the podcast. It left me in total hysterics on a transatlantic flight. Some wine might have been involved, but it terrified everyone because I could not stop bursting out laughing out loud while other people were trying to sleep. Sorry, everybody, but it's that good. And immediately, as soon as I got off the flight, started texting my friends, guys, you have to check out Love at the Store. So watch that and you'll know why I reached out to Jerrod. Now, on the big screen this June, Jerrod joins the cast of Michael Bay's Transformers, The Last Night, opposite Mark Wahlberg, Josh Duhamel, Am I getting that right? Duhamel, and Anthony Hopkins. He'll also appear in James Franco's The Masterpiece, set to be released in 2017. In the summer of last year, 2016, Gerard reprised his role as Garf. If you've seen Neighbors, he did that in the Universal comedy sequel Neighbors 2, opposite Seth Rogen and Zac Efron. I originally met, in an indirect way, Gerard through Seth and Evan, more specifically Evan Goldberg, both of whom have been on the podcast before. He also starred as Freddie opposite Rose Byrne, Susan Sarandon, and J.K. Simmons in The Meddler, which was released April 2016. So this guy's going nowhere but up. As far as I can tell, the most incredible work ethic and focus of anyone I've met in a very long time. And he'll have an upcoming, as yet untitled, memoir coming out through Random House. He's got a million things going. How does he do it? We dig into all of it, and we also discuss dangerous comedy and much, much more. So please enjoy my conversation, as wide-ranging as it is, with Gerard Carmichael. Sir, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I am so excited to finally sit down and record this, because I remember very, very specifically the first time I was introduced to you, and it was actually on the working set for Neighbors 2. You had not yet arrived, but your picture was up alongside a bunch of other people who were going to be appearing in the movie.
Yeah.
And I was on the set because I was going to be interviewing Evan Goldberg and Seth Rogen. And we were going through a few of the names. I was asking questions about folks, and he pointed to yours because I mentioned how I'd watched Neighbors and enjoyed your particular role in that movie. And he said, oh, he's going to be really big. Along those lines is what he said.
Oh, wow.
And,
very nice.
And then shortly thereafter, I think I told you about this, we have all sorts of exciting sounds going on. We got a raven. We got running water.
A raven who's lost her family.
I was on a flight, an international flight, and Love at the Store was one of the options.
Yeah.
So you're special. And it may or may not have been the case that I had one or two glasses of wine.
Oh, that's the only way to watch
it. But it was a sleeper, so everyone was asleep except for me. And I'm drinking wine and watching your stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was going to be kicked out of the cabin because I laughed so much. And as soon as I landed, I did two things. Mm-hmm. So one of my friends, Mike, I immediately sent him a text. And I said, you have to watch this stand-up immediately, number one.
Oh, wow.
And number two is that I went on Twitter, and this is how we met, if you might remember. And I said, is the Evan in your stand-up special Evan Goldberg?
That's right. That's right.
That's how we connected.
That's right. And it was Evan Goldberg
who
was in the audience for the show, and I just talked to him. Just midway through the show, just start talking to Evan.
That was great. I mean, and you do a few things that I haven't seen in finished specials before. Another was you will refer to your notes on stage sometimes.
Yeah, for Love at the Store, like the intention was to just capture me a Saturday night at the Comedy Store. You know, I wanted it to be very, truthfully, we cut for time, but Jamar Neighbors, who's this hilarious guy, my best friend, went up before me. I had this guy, Argus Hamilton, is just like this legend of the Comedy Store and of the scene. He was there. It just felt kind of like a Saturday, we're doing spots, and I wanted to just capture it. And just me working out material, it was very much so like an exercise. It was like, oh, yeah, and I referred it. Notes because I was trying out. I did new stuff on that special.
You did?
Yeah, I did new material.
I also remember asking you about your interactions with the audience. Like at one point you said your skin is so milky.
One woman said,
I don't think I've used that adjective ever in my life.
Yeah, it was. It was the thing that popped in my head. Like I saw her. I was like, yeah, she had really milky skin. What can you say?
You describe it accurately.
It was pretty milky, right?
It was.
I don't want to be wrong.
No, it was very accurately described. How did you first connect with Evan?
Evan, I met, because I want to get this right, I met Josh and Alex who work at this company, and then I believe I met Evan actually on the set of the first Neighbors. I believe he see me, you know, and you know, he and Nick Stoller and Seth, all involved in hiring me. But I'm trying to think, the first time we met, I think, was on set at Neighbors. And he's just like this, I mean, has incredible energy.
His incredible energy.
His incredible energy.
He never sits during meetings.
No.
He's always standing or doing like a Gollum squat.
Yes.
He has very good squat form.
Very amazing squat form. He paces around. He's like, and so many ideas. I've never met someone who has as many like ideas as Evan.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
just like rapid fire, like, and is able to take a thing and like bend it and prod it on all sides, and it's incredible just watching Evan in a room.
He's a prolific generator of ideas.
Insane.
And I remember one of the, and we're going to talk a lot about, I think, how you develop your material and process, but I remember one of the experiences that I had in Atlanta was sitting in the writer's room while they were spitballing ideas.
Yeah.
And one person was manning a keyboard, mm-hmm. typing everything in.
Mm-hmm.
And they had many, many, many different revisions of this script, which, as I understand it, is very kind of Judd Apatow, meaning like what the script comes in looking at is nothing like the end product.
Changes to something else, yeah.
And so they were all shouting out suggestions, and Evan said, fuck, I think, every third word. And it was just typed right in. And I remember at one point, I was like, what's next? Because fuck is every third word.
Yeah.
And he said to me, he goes, no, the important thing, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you want to keep the generating of ideas and the editing of ideas separate, and yeah. you can always defuck the script later. Remember that line?
You can defuck the script later. That's brilliant. You can defuck the script later.
When do you remember, if you do, kind of your first memory of working on comedy or being funny?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I was So when I was a kid, I used to just record things. I was infatuated. We would take like the camcorder and just like record things and do sketches you don't know what they are. There's no form.
Right.
It's like, no, you're just like recording whatever.
Yeah, freestyling.
Freestyling.
When you say we, this is you.
Me, the kids in the neighborhood, my family. You know, everyone's involved and I was really blessed to be around a lot of like creative minds, like people who are just like down and really creative and like really excited about just like jumping into characters and doing things. And so that was kind of the first experience, just kind of truthfully, eighth grade was really important for me, like just comedy, specifically just comedy and thinking that I was maybe funny, you know.
Why eighth grade? What happened in eighth grade?
I had a teacher who got me started reading the newspaper, and it was funny.
Do you remember his or her name?
Oh, Kwame Nyeri. So this guy.
All right.
You know, just Kwame Nyeri had me read the autobiography of Malcolm X, start reading like the New York Times and like the local newspaper, and this is like in eighth grade, and taking in all this information and like learning and kind of discovering myself, like humor was just this big, it was how I broke the tension of any information that I received. So I remember specifically there being one moment in class, I don't know why this stands out so much, but he wanted to have a debate, right? And so we read an article, I don't remember specifically what it was about, but we were choosing, it was a guy that committed a crime and we're deciding whether or not it was justified. And we were supposed to pick sides as a class. And he said, well, who thinks the crime, you know, wasn't justified? And everyone in the class except me raised their hand. And then they were like, well, who thinks it was? And it was just me. And then for the next hour, no exaggeration, I debated like 23 other students on like just like, oh, why this man deserved to commit a crime. And it was the most fun I ever had. It was like having information and then being able to put your own filter and manipulate it in your own way was so important to me. And my comedy has a style or an intention behind it, it's that eighth grade class, me against everyone else in the class. Well,
that's part of the reason why I insisted my friend Mike watch your stuff.
Yeah.
Which I know Mike really well. I mean, 10 out of 10 hit with Mike also. But I remember watching, and I'm not going to spoil it for folks. There are a few instances in particular that, because I don't have the delivery and I wouldn't give you the context, I would get in trouble for just by mentioning. But I recommend everybody check it out. I think there will be a moment for everyone where you will probably feel extremely uncomfortable, offended, or both, and that is good for you.
It's healthy.
So I'll leave it.
It's really healthy.
I'll leave
right?
it at that. But you grew up in North Carolina.
In North Carolina, yeah.
How would you describe your family and childhood?
We had fun. You know, like we had fun. I can't speak for everyone in the neighborhood, but we enjoyed ourselves. Like my childhood was just asking a lot of questions, really, you know, really curious about everything, you know, and a family that allowed room for that. Like, you know, everything was challenged. We questioned everything, like a lot of arguments, you know, like it was constant arguing, but fun arguments, you know, like right. amongst the family and friends in the neighborhood. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed my childhood a lot. I mean, we didn't have like a lot of money, but it was great. It was great. It was like, I had a really creative childhood, I think.
How did your parents help foster that?
They gave me a lot of freedom. And especially in this neighborhood, like I've never had a curfew. I never had a, like, I would just be like, all right, mom, going out. And she's like, all right, be safe. She just said a prayer and just sent me out into the world, you know, and me and my friends, we just kind of go out and, you know, go get in fights and all the silly things that you
throw
do.
Throw dirt in each other's eyes.
Yeah, right. and they just gave me a lot of freedom. Like my mom and dad gave me a lot of freedom. So
what gave them the
which
confidence?
Is so healthy. I hate when I see kids like being inhibited. Like it's like you have to like otherwise. I guess you have to know the child. I guess the specifics of the child mm-hmm. though. But like,
what did your parents do?
My mom was a secretary at the hospital, and my dad a truck driver.
Did that mean your dad was gone a lot of the time?
Or? Yeah, on the road a lot. Yeah, he was on the road a lot. So, you know, me, my brother, and my mom, you know, a lot of times just, you know, I don't know. It was really, I liked the neighborhood. It was so many characters, you know, like you grew up in like a neighborhood like that or the hood or whatever you call it. And it's, you know, so many characters. It's very passionate, very interesting people.
Yeah.
Very passionate. Everyone feels very strongly about everything. You know, like everything is very strong. Like the type of cigarette they smoke, every detail is really, you know, important to them.
What was the catalyst for pursuing comedy as a career, as a profession?
It was a thing that I felt I was really good at. I wasn't doing anything. I was in North Carolina. I was working at a shoe store and just not really doing anything.
Let me ask you maybe a strange question. How did you know you were good?
That's a really good question because it is, I mean, validation to, obviously you want to have, you know, the feeling like inside your heart and know that you can do anything, right? Also, validation is important from outside sources. Like, I mean, you want to confirm that. I mean, if nobody's laughing at some point, even, no matter how much you believe, like maybe this isn't a strength. You want to apply logic to, you know, your dreams and your beliefs. And I had friends who, you know, spoke very passionately about one friend in particular who was like, no, you think like a comedian, like you really should do this. Like it's different. It's like, it's funny, but it's not the way just the guy at your job is funny. It's like different. And she pushed me really hard to do it. And you just kind of know, like it was constant validation.
Right.
From, you know, just in every situation, you're kind of that guy. And, you know, eventually you accept it. You either run from it or accept it.
Were you doing...
I mean, could you imagine I just like rebelled? It's like, no, I'm a lawyer.
Yeah, right.
You know, like...
Were you doing open mics at the time or was it just through social interaction?
No, I started comedy in LA. I moved first and then did comedy because I'm competitive and you should be competitive at some point, you know?
So explain that, meaning you didn't want to do it where you didn't feel... The scene.
I don't want to do it with someone. Yeah, where the scene's not necessarily strong. And truthfully, there are great scenes around the country. There's, you know, Chicago and Atlanta and San Francisco has an amazing comedy scene. You know, but New York, LA. You know, really New York for just repetition's sake. You know, like you can go up so many times, but LA is what like there. it really is the best are here. The best are in New York. Like, you want to be around the best. You don't want to just, you know, there are a lot of people kind of doing comedy. Sure. Everywhere. Look, there's a lot of people kind of doing it in New York and LA too, but also you have these amazing comedians and these people who spend all of their time for you kind of have to create or go to the artist colony for whatever you do, I think, right? Like, you got to find it, and you want to compete, and you want to see what you have to gauge. You have to take the temperature of, you know, whatever we're talking about.
Well, I mean, if you're the average of the five people, we also have a black helicopter coming to pick up some special operations folks who are having lunch next to us.
So many helicopters in LA.
A lot of helicopters in LA.
An insane amount of helicopters.
So, I mean, if you're the average of, say, the five people you associate with most, then going to where the competition is the strongest is really important, right?
So important.
And were your parents at all worried for you? Do you have to have a big conversation with them about packing up and moving west? Or?
Yeah, it was kind of, you know what I've been thinking about, it's been on my mind for a while. A guy came into the shoe store I was working at. Mind you, I'm like 19, 20 at the time.
What were you doing at the shoe store?
Just
selling shoes?
Just selling them, man. Just putting insoles in. Trying to sell you on some cleaner, you know, doing the whole thing. And I did a damn good job, mind you.
Yeah.
You know, finish line. I sold a lot of, you know, I think I deserved more. I mean, I would okay, anyway, but a guy came in and he, you know, just small talk with a, you know, a customer, and I'm like, you know, what do you do? And he said he's an actor, he lives in LA. And I was like, man, I want to move to LA. And he was like, just move. And I was like, wait, what? And he was like, yeah, just move. And then he got me told me about West Side Rentals and Craigslist and all these things. And I just found a place, told my parents. My sister bought me a plane ticket.
Wow.
My brother was excited. They were excited. My mom was more nervous. My dad was really encouraging. But no one's ever done that from my neighborhood. You know, like, no one had ever. I mean, what is that?
Yeah, just move.
You're gonna just move to Los Angeles to do comedy? All right.
Seems to have worked out for you. You always have the shoes to fall back on if the comedy thing
doesn't
work out.
Hey, I am, not to toot my own horn, but I'm fucking amazing. You know, I still can look at like certain shoes and like I know style numbers. Like, I'm just like style numbers. I know what department it is.
All right. So now, what made you good at selling shoes?
I think the same thing that made me good at comedy: interest, competition.
Competition among other employees.
Yeah. Oh, that was fun. My friend Ben used to just, we competed on everything. Like, everything was, because if you're going to do it in that moment, like, you know, you should have a need or at least a curiosity of, well, what does being the best at this feel like? Right? Like
sure.
I went bowling the other night and, you know, I first kind of playing around and then my friends start bowling a little bit better. And I was like, all right, I'm going to start bowling a little bit better. And you just, and before you know it, like, I'm like, at least spares on every front. Like, I was like, I was hot because competition, it drives you.
Makes you better.
Yeah, it makes you better. I love it.
So I want to talk about your daily schedule a little bit because I find it fascinating. Sure. So do you wake up at a consistent time generally, or is it all over the place?
It's kind of all over the place. Okay. I don't sleep a lot. Did I ever tell you changed my life?
I don't think so.
Not disrupting REM cycles.
Yeah.
Is genuinely, it's helped so much for someone like me who really, I mean, I got 4.5 hours last night, which is not bad. It's not bad. Sometimes I'll do three, get solid 90 minute days in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, just, and I actually feel amazing on 90 minutes of sleep.
If you're getting the ultradian cycle, that 90 minutes.
90 minutes.
Or in multiples of those 90, it makes a big difference.
It really helped, like, just. I don't sleep a lot. I mean, certain nights, you know, you can kind of catch up, but I'm usually excited. I'm like, I'll like read until like 4 or 5 in the morning. And then
that's my programming too.
Yeah.
Late.
And then because of certain projects, I have to wake up early.
Right.
You know, like I have to be up at 8 tomorrow, which is, you know, not ideal, but it's fun. I mean, you know, you're up, you do it. We'll jump into some rehearsals or something.
What is the first phone call that you make each morning?
To my mom.
All right. Can you tell us about this?
Because I don't want to start my day with bullshit. I don't like noise. You know, I don't like too much noise, right? As a helicopter flies above, right? I don't like noise. My mom has a great spirit, like one of the purest people that I know. She doesn't overcomplicate anything. She has such a great spirit. I love starting. I won't take business calls before I talk to her. My sister as well. The first call of my day is really important. So sometimes I'll talk to like my sister first as well if my mom's too busy for me or something. But like, I actually really like starting a day, a very peaceful, brief conversation, you know, see what she's doing.
Is it just a general catch up or is there
just kind of general, what are you doing today? Just curious. I'm very curious what she's doing, what she's interested in. You know, like I talk to her for a few minutes and then I'll do other calls. But like you want to start it, you know, in a very peaceful place and then yell about marketing for an hour.
Right. You need the palate, the like spiritual palate cleanser first.
Exactly. Exactly. Because that first moment, like, you know, you just jump into a thing, you know, like you want to center yourself first.
For sure.
Before jumping.
Is there a particular way you end those calls?
Just kind of a sweet, I love you. You know, like a sweet or me. I'm more aggressive than she is. So me, you know, like, hey, make sure I'm trying to make sure my parents are hydrated. So I'm like, I like fuss at her about water every morning. I'm just like, all right, ma, you know, like
have another glass of water.
Yeah. Have a couple liters today, and which is insane to her. And so
there's something about moms and not hydrating. I don't know what
does
it
your
is.
Mom not hydrate?
No.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of mothers of my friends also, their sons or daughters are on them about drinking more water.
Drink more water.
I don't know what it
my
is.
My mom and dad, like I, every day, just like, how much water did you drink? Like, it's the question. So I'm more combative than she is. She's in such a great, constant state of zen. And I'm just like, yeah, but how much, you know, I'm like fussing at her about water.
You love life. That's great. Let's talk about the water.
Yeah.
How many ounces?
Yeah, yeah. How many ounces? Yeah, exactly. And so, but it's just a great way to start the day.
So you have, and I pinged Evan before we met up, mm-hmm. as I mentioned, to try to get some bullets to talk about.
Yeah.
One was, he seems to, well, and again, I'm paraphrasing this, but seems to eat the same things and eat at the same places constantly. And then we sat down, we had a bite to eat just maybe 20 minutes ago. And you had scrambled eggs and blueberries.
Yeah.
And you said, this has been your default, was it lunch for the last...
Breakfast. Well, whatever time breakfast is, but right. Yeah, for years. Blueberries and eggs, I feel great. Blueberries and eggs, you know, and I used to do almonds, now walnuts. Start the day, you know, like that's the... I'm a creature of habit, you know, and I like the restaurant, and I like everything to kind of move efficiently. I like the... You know, the rhythm, you walk into a restaurant, you know what you're getting, you know, you bring friends, they're familiar with you, you're familiar with them.
Saves you brain cycle.
Yeah, exactly. Because you can put all that energy toward like creating, thinking, figuring things out, you know.
So you also mentioned something and I was like, wait, hold it. I don't want to talk about it. I want to talk about it. Actually, I do want to talk about it when we're recording, that you had a uniform for a very long time.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wearing the same... I bought like a lot of the same shirt. It was just like white sweatshirt, gray pants, like Timberlands every day. Every day. It worked in any place that I went. That's what I like. It worked everywhere.
Flexible.
I'll go to your wedding in this thing. I'll go to, and just the same thing. And because it took out so much time in my morning.
That's very much now, Steve Jobsian. That's what he did.
Yeah, but now I'm like off a little bit. It's still kind of in the same.
Why did you change it?
I mean, clothes are fun. You know, I like certain clothes, and you know, I'll go through a phase and just and I'm picking out, you know, a lot of like wardrobe for like the show and stuff like that. So I'm thinking about clothes,
right?
You know, but you want intention behind everything. So, you know, I was just wearing the same thing. It was perfect. I'll go back to that. Yeah, I'll go back to that.
What do you think your next uniform will be? Or will
maybe
it be the same
thing. It worked. But maybe switch. Maybe a gray sweatshirt.
Go crazy.
White James Purse sweatshirt, Acne jeans,
and some Timberlands.
That's it. Every morning. You don't think about it. It's just in stacks. I just had stacks of the shirts and stacks of the pants, and just grab the one off the top.
Do you remember the first time that you bombed, or what was the first memorable bomb?
Ooh, my first set.
Your first set.
My first set was just I mean, atrocious.
This was open mic
at the Comedy Store. Nobody was in the audience. It was an open mic. I went up first at the open mic. The sun was up. I was competing against the sun. And it's this giant window, and it's where I taped my first special. It was like the giant window at the
Comedy
Store.
This is in the original?
The original room of the Comedy Store, yeah. And it's August, and the sun is up, and there are just comedians in the back. So I guess technically I didn't bomb, but it was a soliloquy. I was just doing a soliloquy up there. It wasn't comedy. I just went up and just kind of talked way too fast and got off the stage.
Talked way too fast.
Yeah.
How would you coach, or what advice would you give to a comic? You see someone, they do a set and they just bomb and they're new and they come off and you can tell that they're totally demoralized. What do you say to that person?
It's just people.
What do you mean?
Like the audience, it's people. We're all just people, you know, like it's no... You know, go do it again. But I honestly, sometimes the bombing indicates that you're going to, you know, some type of new territory for you. And only you know you. So, like, sometimes it's good. It's a good thing. It's kind of like a cleansing, you know. And so you can't run from it. You know, tell yourself it'll never happen again. It will. But tell yourself that it won't and go do it again. You know, and stop. You know, I wonder if it's like this I know comedy really well, but everyone's like kind of looking for like rules to follow. And the sooner you realize there aren't any, the better art can be, you know, like it's like, cause people start looking for like, well, you got to do this first. And you know, for that first special, I remember, I got a lot of like flack from, especially like older comics. And you're just like, well, he's checking his notes on HBO. What is this kid doing?
And you're like, you're in the Ten Commandments of comedy.
Yeah, where? You know what I mean? Mort Saul checked his nose. You know, he was fun. Like, you can do whatever you want. You can, and people don't accept that. People don't know how free they are.
My understanding with the, just to talk about the original room, do they let cameras in there a lot?
That was the first time anyone had taped anything in there.
How did that happen?
I mean, we were pretty persistent. I had a really specific vision. You know, me and my friend Andrew talked about specifically what it would look like and what that first special would be. And so it just had to be that room. So it was just pretty insistent. And, you know.
Now, they, of course, have the power to say no, right? So you can't just hit them with the same pitch 40 times in a row.
Yeah.
They're going to be like, well, then, but fuck on off, the, kid, number one.
But on the 35th time, smile more. Uh-huh. You just smile, you know, you add a little. We were just pretty, I mean, that room had been very special to me, and it just kind of worked out. We, you know, I'm very thankful. They had never done it before, but there was no reason to not do it just because you've never done it before. So, you know, I guess you were able to convince them, you know, HBO. I wasn't just bringing, you know, it wasn't just like me and a couple friends with camcorders. This was like, it's like HBO.
You didn't bring your over the shoulder VHS.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like, hey, but let us release this. Like, this was HBO, you know, and you know, because of that certain amount of exclusivity, I think it was a good first time for them. Yeah. I think some people have recorded in there since, but like no one, and especially in that room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had my first ever walkthrough tour of Comedy Store by,
what was that?
Brian Callen a while back.
You know, Brian Callen bought me my first car in LA.
Really?
Brian Callen and Dove Davidoff bought me a car. I was
never
walking.
Met Dove, also one of my favorites.
They're both incredible. Like I'm so thankful for them. And like really, like it was like Brian Callen, Dove Davidoff, Brett Ernst would look out for me, Al Madrigal would look out, and all these people were just like really. Bill Burr was like so nice to me, but Brian and Dove bought me a car.
Wow!
Because I was like walking, and like you shouldn't do it. And I got like a text like, go pick up your car. Like we'd done a weekend in La Jolla, and then on that Monday, I just got a text like, go pick up your car. It was one of the nicest things.
Good guys.
Brian is amazing.
He's a sweetheart. He's a sweetheart of a guy.
So funny. He's so great.
And he walked me through and he's like, yeah. And then here's the table. You can see all the scratch marks from razor blades.
Oh, yeah.
Where all the comedians are doing lines.
There's a little piano in one of the green rooms. And it's a little tiny glass piano. Not a real piano. It's just a table, a coffee table. It looks like one. it's so many lines, and we like to, me and my friend Angelo used to like to point to the lines and assign them to certain comedians, like, oh, there's Richard Pryor's, like just assign it to like
his razor blade signature.
It's still there. We're so excited.
What other routines do you have that are important to you, or things that you repeat? You mentioned the food, which for me is extremely key.
Yeah,
I don't want to have to think about what to have for breakfast.
Yeah,
locations. I repeat locations all the time. You mentioned the clothing, which is something that has been true for me for a long time, but I've aspired to have a uniform.
Yeah.
More of a uniform. Also to make me care less about what people think of my external appearance.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Like, if you just have like a white Hanes shirt and jeans, it's totally fine. And if people are judging you because of that, then...
People, the people that matter realize that all that you should focus on is the work.
Right.
Now, at clothing or all these things as it relates to work are important.
Right.
You know, like it's a lot of intention behind, like I said, like wardrobe for the show with that type of thing. I think about that because I think everything should have some type of intention behind it. But as far as just like, make you feel good. I mean, obviously, clothing can, you know, make someone feel good, but focus on like work, focus on something of substance that means something, you know. And that's why, because if being a creature of habit works so good, because you don't spend a lot, and you were talking about like listening to music while working, right? And we're talking, if you spend all of your energy trying to figure out where you are and reorient yourself, like all right, well, what is this? And you're looking around, you're not focused on what you're supposed to focus on. So you go to the same place, you sit in the same spot, and you just, so then you can ignore everything and you can just, you know, be directed inward.
Well, we were talking about music, just to touch on that, because I'm able to work to certain types of music, generally instrumental, often electronica, but it seems like neither of us can work to jazz.
Yeah, I want to figure it out. I play it sometimes and try and write, but I just want to figure it out. It's like, man, what is Miles Davis doing right now?
You're trying to dissect what's happening.
Yeah, you want to
how it's composed.
It's on a whole, and so I have to, I just listen to it separate. I can think to it, you know, and like just, but if I'm like writing or if I'm trying to work on something really specific, like just silence.
What are some of the best decisions that you made in the first few years of your career? You land in LA. Do you remember any of the decisions that
maintain a certain amount of exclusivity for yourself?
What does that mean?
I think, for instance, like you don't go. We're just talking about habits, so it's going to seem like it immediately contradicts it. But like even like open mics, I wouldn't do the exact same open mics every time, because you do it, you do well, and then move on to the next place, like stay in motion, you know. And that's specifically for, you know, what I was doing, and I'm sure it applies to other things too, but you know, don't stay in one spot too long, you know. As
don't get too comfortable,
you know, like while working, you know, like while that sounds like the complete opposite of what I just said, but I mean it for like doing stand up and like that type of thing. Hit up the same spots. Like,
well, there's also a big difference maybe, and sorry to interrupt, but I just thought that maybe there's a big difference between having habit and routine for training,
yeah,
but then performing, you want to be able to do well in different environments.
Spread it out. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That training is one thing. And when you work, thank you very much. Saved me. It sounded like a complete, it's like,
I think you were doing fine.
But wait, what?
No.
But it is that. It is that. Like, and so that was really useful. Surrounding yourself with like-minded people. All my friends, I'm the thing that I feel luckiest with is like the group of people that I'm around. I really have excellent friends who like care about like making things and creating, and like don't get caught up in trivial things that won't matter tomorrow. Like, we don't get caught up in things that don't matter tomorrow. Don't get me wrong, we like new experiences and we like, you know, having fun. But we like work. I mean, I was at my office with friends until 6 this morning, 5 or 6 this morning, just work. And it's
this is a Sunday.
Yeah.
As context.
Yeah. On Saturday night, my entire Saturday, I don't go out really. Like, I don't do too much. Like, you know, every now and then, but for the most part, like, just work. And my friends think like that, you know.
Did you seek them out? Was it luck? How did that happen? Did you look at the people you met and say, all right, this guy talks about too much trivial bullshit, I'm just going to have to spend less time with this person?
Yeah,
how did that happen?
You can kind of see it in certain people. You know, one of my best friends, Ari, we both have such small social lives, virtually non-existent social lives, that it just works. Like, we aren't, you know, we'll go work, like, right after this, I'll go meet up with him and we'll go write, and we enjoy it. It is so fun, and we don't get, like, it's not like, if I heard someone talk about, like, oh, I want to find a bar to go watch the game at, while that sounds fun and I'm really happy for you, I also know that we're just doing two different things. We're in two different channels. Like, it's like, wait, why are we going to find a bar? What? I mean, watch it on your phone in between writing or in between doing what you do. But what? Why are you doing that?
Have you always had that focus on deep work? Is it because, I mean, it doesn't sound this way, but is it because you were maybe unpopular in school, so you spent a lot of time alone? Like, where do you think that comes from? Or is it something that your parents really instilled in you?
My parents definitely hard workers, you know. I'm really lucky to be able to do something that I enjoy, you know, a lot, and to focus all my time and energy into that. But yeah, I like, because I like focusing on things that matter. Mm-hmm. You know, you go into a nightclub, right? You go to a nightclub, there's a lot of good looking people hanging out, right? The thing that really changes the energy is when someone who's accomplished something walks in, right? Like, you know, like, you walk in and it's just people that are, there are some people just there to party, and there are certain people there as, like, just a brief escape from doing something. And those are the people. So I would rather be that guy than just,
for sure,
you know, you're what, just going to hang out.
Spectator.
Yeah, spectator. Like, don't be a spectator in life in any capacity. Like, go do something.
Okay, so speaking of clubs. Mm-hmm. This is another bullet from Evan. So he said, and this, you feel free to refute this.
Okay.
So Evan and his wife took you dancing at one point, and he said that you'd never been to a proper dance party before.
Not really. Yeah, this was in Texas. We're at South By. Yeah, we're in South By, and it was like Lisa was saying, we're gonna go dancing. I was like, oh, really? I was like, I never really went to just a dance, like, that type of dance club. Sure. I had never done it before. So we went, and just like that, it was fun. It was really fun. I don't think I've been since. It was fun. I'm waiting for Evan and Lisa, you know, to take me again. But it was really, really fun. That's true. That's so rare. It's so rare that I, like, go out. And I'm trying right now. I haven't done stand-up in a little while. I'm trying to try to squeeze in a few more like new experiences and things like that, like, when I can. But I find myself getting bored constantly. Like, if I'm not working, I get bored. Evan, at least that night was fun.
Yes, I need. I feel like I've been cheated on by Evan. He's never taken me dancing.
No, he never took you dancing. I mean, now he's got a kid.
Oh, no, I know, that's true.
He's gonna go dancing again.
May not have much dancing time. But if you were to think of anything that occurs to you as mistakes that novice comedians or stand-up comedians make, what are some common mistakes?
People focus on the wrong things. There are a lot of comedians who aren't funny at all or don't have stage presence, but have excellent websites. You know, like, they have excellent websites and the shiniest business cards, and the headshots are impeccable. And who gives a fuck?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, they focus on the wrong things. If you focus on, and we actually just talked about that, like, if you focus on the work, I think that's all it is. Like, just focus on the content. Focus on exactly what you're putting out.
If you had to choose three comedians of any type to combine into one super comedian,
mm-hmm,
for yourself right, ooh, now, who comes to mind, and why would you pick them? Understanding that I'm sure you have a lot of influences and there are a lot of incredibly funny people out there, but
just like current,
they don't, alive or dead.
Oh, ooh, that's interesting. Richard Pryor, I mean, just for being raw and you got to say Richard, right? He's the Tupac of comedy, right? You know, every list.
Also, probably one of my mom's, if not favorite comedians, top three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's, I mean, because he was honest, right? So Richard Pryor for honesty. Bo Burnham, he's a friend of mine, but I mean it wholeheartedly. Like, Bo Burnham, because he's one of my favorite people to just watch perform. He's such a performer. He's like, your eyes never move away from him while he's on stage. You're always excited, and he's one of the most brilliant people I've ever met. And oh, that's a good one. That's a good, what's a good, that third spot is hard because it's like, you know, Lewis Black has amazing timing. Ellen draws people in such a great way.
Ellen DeGeneres?
Ellen DeGeneres is so good. I did a show and I told her, I was like, you got to do stand-up again. She was really good at stand-up. Oh, man.
It doesn't have to be just three. I mean, you can take those,
yeah, I mean,
take
I
those
mean,
four.
Like, those are, yeah, those that I named are great. I mean, you know, it's hard to say Cosby now to someone without then a slew of other questions. But I mean, as far as a comedian, he was, I mean, excellent. And I mean, his rhythm and control over a room was great. Chris Rock, man, it's hard.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of greats out there. What in general do you think separates a...
Dave Chappelle's obviously, you know,
incredible. What separates a good working comedian from a great comedian?
Good from great. I think honesty, you know, and by honesty, I mean just like your own truth, whatever excites you, whatever you're excited to perform or say or do on stage, you know, being honest to that, an understanding of perception. Because as a performer, you have to know how this is coming across. Right. And you have to adjust accordingly because, you know, sometimes you want to make sure the intention is showing and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you think you're being like, I get on stage and I'm so, you know, like I'm honest and I'm these things. And it may seem like you're just bullshitting,
right.
You know, like
right.
You have to be aware of what the audience is seeing, you know. Yeah. A business sense, like a good sense of realizing that it is the you know, an industry, mm-hmm. You know, it is because a lot of times comedians get frustrated with certain things, but it's like, yeah, that's part of any a business. Like, you know, understanding business to a certain extent is really important. I think having an appreciation for it helps too. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can learn to appreciate the, you know, it's hard with art because you want to keep it separate and you want to make something that's pure, but you also want to know how to market it and you also want to know how to, you know, that's really important.
It's tough. I mean, and as you pointed out with the shiny business cards and the websites, it's the marketing can turn into a crutch and a tool for procrastinating doing the work.
Yeah, absolutely.
The deep work.
Absolutely. You make this thing and then you figure out, all right, well, how do we get this in the right hands? You know, how do we make sure the right people see and hear this?
Your onstage persona seems, and maybe this will sound strange, but a little darker than your sort of in real life persona. Is that a deliberate decision or is that just how the inner truths come out? What is the...
It's a certain amount of comfort on stage. I'm in this environment where I can share these thoughts, no matter how dark or how weird they may be. It's like, you know, in this lovely setting, I wish we could see just this, in this lovely
we're
setting.
Sitting in an outdoor garden with wooden tables with our pomegranate tea, sparkling water, and blueberries.
Yeah, yeah. It's super delightful and not the place for some of my
dark thoughts.
The darkest thoughts and like things that I want to explore. I mean, I'm open to any conversation. I actually prefer, you know, the realer the conversation, the better. Like, you know, small talk is obviously boring and you don't want to get caught up in that type of thing. But on stage, I'm just so comfortable sharing. You know, it's something that kind of clicks and you're just like, oh, okay, this. And
well, I suppose that's the environment for it, right? I
mean, that's the environment.
That's
yeah.
where you have the immunity bracelet too.
I mean,
as the sort of
socially, you have certain cautions. I'm sorry. You have certain cautions and certain things that you don't want to cross because, you know, again, in this environment, you don't want to make people uncomfortable. They may not, they didn't sign up for that. Right. But I try and enter stage with zero fear. And just, yeah, this is what I wanted to say.
What do you, so to achieve that state of zero fear, I'm sure repetition has a lot to do with it, but let's say before your special,
mm-hmm.
The first special. What did you say to yourself before getting on stage, or what did your pregame look like?
I tried to keep it honest to any performance. That one I remember just being in the back, and I remember there being like a couple too many people in the green room. You gotta like kind of ask to leave, and it just you just want to think about jokes and like. The first tape, and I was too aware of the production, and then that same night you do two shows, so then the second show it was just kind of like, yeah, I'm not thinking about the production at all, like I just want to think about the material because that's what we wanted to capture. So I was in the right space by the second show. The first show I was still kind of a producer, you know, and I was still cameras and this type of thing and a bit more, you know, hands-on, and then the second show I was just.
So you seem like a very confident guy. When do you have self-doubt, or can you remember a point any time in your life when you had like a particularly dark period or a lot of self-doubt?
I mean, as a kid, if you don't know exactly who you are, then it leaves room for so many questions. So and that's self-doubt manifesting itself in that form of just questioning everything about you, and once you kind of figure that out, so truthfully humor played a big role in that. Like, so I'm kind of have a similar demeanor since the eighth grade, I think since the eighth grade, since discovering that, it's kind of been a similar, you know, vibe for me. Yeah. Just like you know, I know what I'm good at, I know what my abilities are, and anything else I don't really care about.
What's your position on writer's block?
It's necessary, you know, it's a necessary, it's natural, you know, there you can try and get yourself out of it, you just kind of have to release it. And maybe a lot of times I realize for me it means that I'm holding on too tight and I'm trying too hard maybe a certain thing, and I just need to like let it go.
How do you do that?
Focus on something else. You know, focus on something else, and then it'll come to you.
This is a very exciting location.
It is very exciting. Oh, there are a lot of people on a balcony.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people jumping around
and
across the street,
screaming on a balcony, and it looks like it's going to end horrible. A man just skated out on a balcony. Oh, this is going to end very bad.
Wow. Yeah, there's a lot of excitement
or
here.
Not, or it's someone's birthday. I don't know why I immediately went to a negative. Like, oh, there's no way this ends good. There's no way. Oh, there's definitely domestic abuse going on in there. You got someone. I mean, if you see something, say something. But I'm saying something.
I see a poodle, and it looks like it's on the edge of the precipice. But
yeah,
so much going on in Los Angeles today.
Yeah.
What types of things do you shift your focus to when you're trying to let go? Does that mean you go bowling? Does that mean you
a lot of times,
watch a movie?
A lot of times, yeah, I like taking in other content, you know, so maybe watch a movie, watch something that's interesting, read a book, go on a walk.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been walking as much as I used to walk around all the time. I did the other night in the rain. It was one of the greatest nights ever. I just like walked around in the rain for like 2 hours and listened to Marvin Gaye.
That sounds amazing. What precipitated that?
It was raining, and I had 2 hours. I had 2 hours free. It was late. I should have been asleep, but I was like, oh, it's raining. I was leaving dinner, and I was like, oh, I'm just going to go on a walk. And I was like, I was on my way back to my place, and I was like, no, I'm just going to go on a walk. And I didn't think it was going to be that long, but it was like 2 hours in the rain. The hood off, kept the hood off, just let it. Yeah, it was great.
Why did you decide to keep the hood off?
Just wanted to experience the rain.
I like it.
It was rain, you know, like it was like if I'm gonna be in the rain, I'm gonna be in the rain.
Right.
You know, if you gotta do it.
Don't deny the experience.
Like so I just walked around. It was great.
You mentioned books. Do you like to read?
It's fun. It's really fun. I like biographies, and I like I'd never been a guy that got into like novels, and we were talking about like science fiction books earlier, because I always like information. Sure. Like I was like, I want information, you know, like, and then I'll create a thing, but I just want information. I read the book, The Sellout. Yeah. It's excellent. The language.
Is it a novel?
It reminds me of like, language wise, of like Confederacy of Dunces. It's like, sure. The language is so good. It's so, they're sent, I literally was like driving around repeating like sentences from the book just over and over. It's so good.
How did you choose The Sellout? Was it recommended to you or?
A friend of mine recommended it to me, and it just won. I'm sure a lot of people have read it. It won, I can't remember the Booker Prize. It won the Booker Prize. Yeah. But a friend of mine recommended it to me. And the language in it is, I mean, the language excites me, you know, because it's so well written.
Crafted.
So well crafted.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's these lines that you just, I wish I could think of.
You mentioned Malcolm X. Are there any other autobiographies or biographies that you could recommend?
I wish I remember who wrote it, but I read the Humphrey Bogart biography that I loved. God, I wish I knew the author.
I can look it up and I'll put it in the show notes for folks.
Yeah, and his story is so interesting, and just like him kind of starting so late, you know, like or getting the recognition so late. But like any good thing, like we found a man who knew who he was. By the time he achieved stardom, he knew exactly who he was. So it was so.
If you were talking to someone, because this has come up a few times, who had the self-doubt because everything was open to question,
mm-hmm.
they hadn't discovered something like comedy early on, how would you suggest they learn who they are?
Sit alone. Be alone. Sit in silence. You know what I mean? Like, and not just saying like some, you know, shaman-esque experience where someone will just sit and think, go on, get to know yourself and be honest with your, like the responses that you have, you know, emotionally to things. Like, know what you're good at, have an honest assessment of yourself, honest assessment of your life, and know what you're good at and know where you can contribute the most. Find out where you can control, because it's not always through work. You know, like a lot of people, sometimes people make the mistake of like thinking it's always through what you won't always have necessarily that career, but your life can be fulfilled and you can contribute in a meaningful way, you know, to those around you, to, you know, your environment. So just try and contribute.
Well, I think what you said just before that also is really important, and that is being aware of how you emotionally respond to things.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot, and I did this for a long time, I learned how to mute that because I was trying to be so hyper analytical that I didn't pay attention to my visceral response to things. And that is this massive computing power of the subconscious that is telling you something, and I learned to override it for so long.
Yes.
And I only really in the last few years have felt very comfortable in my own skin. It's because I've started to, I think in part, pay a lot more attention to that. If I'm sitting with someone and the deal they're pitching sounds great, but mm-hmm. I just feel off around them,
yeah,
I pay more attention to that now.
Because this is someone that you're going to work with a lot. You know, like you're going to have a lot of interactions with. And if something is off, if it's just not right, then something's going to go wrong.
Yeah.
You know, like it's going to hit. It's that feeling is going to be addressed either immediately or it's going to be delayed. And I'd rather address it now
up front
and avoid. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Like a disaster.
Yeah. A 10x compounded disaster later.
Exactly.
And it took me a long time to learn that a good contract doesn't make a good relationship
at all.
At all.
At all.
It's basically just, this is what happens if we get a divorce, but it doesn't ensure you're going to have a good marriage.
Does it? That's excellent. It doesn't ensure a good marriage.
When you hear the word successful, to you, who comes to mind?
Oh, man. Jay-Z, Steve Jobs, Jerry Seinfeld, Oprah.
All good names, all well-known names. Is there any particular commonality for you?
Honesty. They're themselves. They're very unapologetic about being themselves. That's pretty much it. And yeah, they've found a way to let that come out in an artful way. Like in through their work or their art and their careers, like they found a way to build a career around them, mm-hmm, as opposed to, you know,
bending themselves to what they perceive as a career.
Exactly. So those are
I don't know if you're much of a gift giver, but do you give books or anything else to people as gifts? Like, what are your go-to gifts?
If I'm excited about anything, then I try and share it with everybody in my life immediately. If I go to a new restaurant and I love it, all of my friends have gone there with me. At some point, I'm bringing everybody. I need you to share it. And I also want to talk about it with you.
Yeah.
You know, I want to have an exchange. I want to like analyze it. I love that. That's what I live for. So like, if I love a book, then I send it to everybody.
What is the last book or any books that come to mind that you've done that with?
What's the last book that I sent to everybody? There was this book by Eric Butterworth, Discover the Power Within You, that kind of interpreted the Bible in an interesting way to me. And the way that I feel like I always knew and understood it, you know, or the way I wanted to understand it. And it articulated it in such a great way that I was like, everybody, religious, not religious, it's really good about discovering self, about answers being within, about that.
Eric Butterworth.
His name makes you want waffles. Right? Or like just
it does.
Yeah.
It does now, especially since you've now said it. Now I really want waffles.
Yeah.
Do you remember the title, or I can find the title?
Yeah, Discover the Power Within You. I don't like the title.
Yeah.
So you know.
Yeah, sure.
Just very putting literal. It out there. It's very, it's a bit on the nose. It's a bit on the nose.
Like,
nothing else. Nothing else. I guess it's good. I mean, you know, there are no unanswered questions in that title, but I sent it to everybody. I mean, atheist friends got that book. You know what I like about like that book? People, I noticed what people, the people who got it and the people who didn't, it was like accepting certain truths sound really cheesy.
Yeah.
Right. And if you can get people won't allow themselves to accept it, like just, like certain, you know, that you are what you think and you are what you believe types of things, and like that you do need to affirm certain principles, like sounds super cheap. And don't get me wrong, like, because I analyze everything and I'm like pick on everything, and I get that it's, if you can get beyond that and just accept it and don't make yourself feel guilty about it.
Sure.
I really think it, like, a lot of principles in it can change your life.
It makes me think of a guest I had on some time ago, Shay Carl, who's a huge YouTube celebrity, is I think close to 3 billion views now.
Insane.
And he's also a very atypical YouTube star in the sense that it's the Shaytards. It's Shay and his family.
Mm-hmm.
Bunch of kids in Utah.
Oh,
and
really?
So it's not the typical fast cut, you know, 18-year-old making videos for 12-year-old setup.
Yeah.
It's very atypical in that sense. But he said whenever, and again, paraphrasing, but roughly when you hear a cliche, pay attention because a truth is being told. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that's true of all cliches. I don't think it is. But I've come to appreciate things that I always disregarded because I heard them too often, like water under the bridge, don't cry over spilt milk.
Yes.
You learn to turn off your interpretation of that. You just disregard it.
You disregard it. And you're looking for, well, what's the real answer?
It's like, no, that's actually really deep.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
Things that your fourth grade teacher told you.
Yeah.
Kind of true.
Yeah.
Wait, I can be anything?
Yeah.
It's hard to accept because the world just jades you. It makes you, what is the world doing us?
If you had to give, say, a TED Talk about something you're not known for, so it can't be comedy,
mm-hmm,
probably can't be television, can't be writing, what topic would you choose?
choosing the right friends, choosing, like, I think that, like, choosing the right people to be around that will spark certain things within you, and knowing how you can use each other, mm-hmm. you know, and how you can contribute to each other's lives. I think I could.
So this is such an important topic. Mm-hmm. If for people listening who say, yes, I want to learn more about this, is there some recommendation or an exercise or an action step or something I should do more of or less of? Is there an action that you could recommend?
Don't dismiss anyone, right? Actually look for, this is going to sound so cheesy, right? But at my best, I do this like this exercise, and I could have read this somewhere. I'm not even saying that I've made this up. I think I did, but I may have read it somewhere. So my apologies. But it's like I pretend I'm at the bottom of a well, and every face that I see, I imagine them being the face that peers over inside and has the ability to help me and like rescue me from something. And it makes you look at everyone looks, first of all, amazing.
When you're at the bottom of a well.
When you're at the bottom of a well and everyone looks in. And that's like just an exercise for just people in general. But it really means that everyone does have an ability to give something to you, and just kind of looking for that and searching for that first.
Right.
In people. It helps tremendously.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's a really visual.
Yeah,
exercise for me, which helps too. I'm just very visually hardwired.
You see it. If you do that, like I was at like outside a movie theater, and I was doing it once, and just everyone was glowing. Yeah. You know, like everyone was just like, "Oh man, you! Thank you, thank God for you! Oh, I'm so happy you're here."
Outside a movie theater, were you waiting for someone, or were you just?
I was loitering.
Loitering,
literally. Loitering outside of a movie theater. Like it was years ago. I was like, I left the movie and I was just sitting outside of it, loitering. Just kind of thinking.
Just sitting with yourself.
Being a weirdo. being a guy who clearly doesn't have a girlfriend.
what is bad advice that is given out frequently in your world? And you can pick any world that you're involved with.
Anything that begins with you gotta,
yeah,
you ain't gotta do anything. like you got, oh, in my world, where do I begin? It's mostly, it's 99.9% bad advice.
Yeah.
And it's such a new, scary world, like especially entering into comedy or television or film, and you're looking for answers.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to figure it out, but nobody knows what they're doing. Nobody knows what they're talking about. Everyone's making it up. You know, and it's, a lot of times it's the sort, people can only tell you what works for them, and maybe that applies to you, you know, like as far as technical things, like maybe that applies to you, maybe it doesn't. So even just like, I don't know, the worst thing is just like looking for it. It's probably like looking for like advice. Just don't listen to anybody.
Or if you're looking for advice and it starts with you gotta
see when you have, you gotta, like, it's usually people like aren't where they want to be.
Yeah.
The person who just readily hands out advice is usually not where they want to be. You know, like busy, sure. Busy people aren't just around in the back telling you what you got to do next.
Although if someone finds you loitering in front of a movie theater.
Yeah, yeah. I may be, you know.
Like, available for advice.
I like to think I loiter the way Socrates does, but we all like to think the best of ourselves.
Oh, man. What is your favorite, or do you have any favorite failures? Meaning a failure or something that was perceived as a failure by you or other people that ended up setting the stage for greater successes.
They had this comedy showcase in San Diego years ago. It was just starting off, and it was the NBC diversity showcase. I should have never done that. Should have never gone down. I went down to it. I didn't make it to the final round, mind you. Thank God. Oh my God. It could have ended horribly. Tim. Like, cause if had I made it to the final round, I would not have a show on NBC.
Why do you say that?
Because they would have put me in a box. I'm the diversity kid.
The diversity champion.
Yeah, the diversity champion. It's like when in, like Miss America. Like, what, I'm gonna go around and like
that's do a on couple your bio parades for the rest and wave.
Yeah, that's your that. It's immediately like a box that you're in. I'm so thankful I didn't. Like, and it's really just a thing that people do to feel good about. Yeah, feel good about themselves, like the sure. corporations do to feel oh, good about right. themselves. You know, sure. like I'm so thankful. I call that one of my biggest mistakes. Do even going. I'm so thankful that I didn't make it to the final round of that, because it would have ruined everything. Like seeking any shortcut or easy answer is always a mistake. You know,
question
the
you.
Pyramid scheme of it all.
Pyramid you know scheme I mean? Of comedy.
Of comedy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like so I'm really happy I did that, because it made me ignore anything that could be remotely like I would. For me personally, and I'm not, because people have benefited from this and have turned it into lucrative, amazing careers. But for me personally, like any, I would never do any type of reality competition type. No, I wouldn't. I always refused that. And like the closest I came was like within my first year doing that.
How do you walk? And maybe it's not a fine line, but I'm sure people think about this. How do you establish a unique style yourself
mm-hmm.
without getting pigeonholed?
Listen to yourself.
Yeah.
Listen to what you want to do. And if you don't want to do it anymore, stop. Change, you know, like grow, change, evolve. You are unique, you know. The most unique thing you can do is be yourself.
Yeah.
You know, this is, God, I sound like a real substitute teacher right now. A real substitute teacher.
No, but just it's wants true. Who is it? Groucho Marx or Oscar Wilde? I always confuse those two, but it's like, be yourself. Everybody else is taken.
Everybody else is taken. That's yeah. It's a perfect way of saying it. Like that's.
And if you want to sound like a substitute teacher, I'll just sound like a fortune cookie or like the back page of a newspaper that's full of quotes. But also you mentioned something earlier, which was the people who matter don't mind. And Dr. Seuss has a great quote.
Yes.
The people who mind don't matter and the people who matter don't mind.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. It really, Dr. Seuss got it.
Yeah, Dr. Seuss had a lot to him.
Yeah, yeah. That guy was, oh man. I went, I go on stage and you see a lot. What's interesting about comedy is that you get to see a lot of immediate examples of what you're doing. Like just like
you mean in terms of immediate feedback?
Well, not even feedback, but like the competition type of thing. Like if you're in maybe in a tech world, like some type of expo, you know, where you get to see what other people are doing.
Right.
With comedy, that's every night. Every night there's a new, you know, it's a new
showcase.
Like the 3E what's the electronics expo? Whatever.
Oh,
like
CES?
CES and all that type of stuff. It's like Comic-Con every night, you know, like you're just seeing what everybody's doing. Right. And so you get to know where you are in context of your world pretty quickly.
Well, especially if you've chosen to put yourself in a place like LA.
Yes. That's why it's important for me. That's why it was important. And to some people, I mean, it's good. I mean, I'm sure you could find immediately a story that is like, well, this guy was in, you know, Kansas and did all right for himself. But like, I really think that knowing where you fit in context, like if, you know, doing a television show, I watch all the television shows. Doing film, I'm watching every film, especially current, like, because you want to know where you fit in. You want to know where you fit in history, and you want to know where you fit in the current landscape. So it's important to be informed, you know, for me. Again, for me, it is, you know, I like to know.
So when you moved out here to do comedy, did you have in your mind any backup plan? Like if the comedy doesn't work out, or I'm going to give myself 6 months, or any type of thinking along those lines?
No plan B for me. I mean, I had an aunt who, the closest I came to a plan B was that I was in LA for a little bit, and I have an aunt in New York that I was like, well, if it doesn't work for some reason here and I'm just homeless, then I'll go stay with her,
mm-hmm.
you know?
And, no, that's, and, I mean, and that's a plan B, right? I mean, that's a, but it's a, mentally you had
it was, yeah.
de-risked it for yourself in a way.
Yeah, but really that was even like a, that was a long shot to make.
Right.
You know, like, even, and I would have been just gone to New York and done the exact same thing that I'm doing here.
Right.
You know, like, so it was kind of just another route to plan A for me.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. It was, I was just, that, so that was the closest to a B. It was like a, it was like an 8.5.
Just taking another lap around the track.
Yeah. What's the, yeah, exactly. It's like, all right, well, cause I was just here just doing stand up and I was like, well, and that was purely a logistic thing where I was like, well, if I can't, like, I just literally can't sleep on the street, I guess.
Frowned upon.
Which I would have been, I would have been cool with for a little while. Like, God, thank God I didn't have to, but I would have been cool with that. I loved it. I loved doing comedy. So I would have just gone to New York and just, you know, stayed there.
If for whatever reason, at some point, you stop liking comedy, mm-hmm. let's just say, but you need to keep yourself busy, what would you do instead?
I'd take an educated swing at something else. I don't know. I just stop liking comedy.
Or you were like, you know what? I've been doing this for, let's say, down the road, you're like 20 years, 30 years in. Okay, I just need a gear shift for a little bit to come back to this fresh.
I don't know. I'd probably do some weird artist stuff. Go like, you know, be like Bob Dylan, start painting. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know, like just like record some songs in a nice basement.
Yeah.
Release it under an alias. That type of stuff.
Sure.
Like probably something creative or something like really specific. Or just substitute teach for a little bit. You know, like just see what I don't know.
All right. Well, hopefully you'll be in love with comedy for a very long time to come. If you had a huge billboard and you could put any short message on it or an image, non-commercial, just to get something out to the world, what would you put on it?
Oh, wow. I mean, come on, man. That's a great... Give me a second. You're going to have to edit out a long pause.
Oh, that's... I like the pauses. I'll let the silence do the work on this one.
Oh, man. Oh, this is... I mean... Yeah, this is genuinely hard because you're like, probably don't listen to anybody. Yeah, you know, like, and obviously that comes with the, obviously you'll collaborate with people and you'll be so inspired by others and there are people that you'll work with, and but what I mean is just like anything that directs you away from you, ignore it.
Or anything that starts with you gotta.
Anything that starts with you gotta. You ain't gotta do anything, man. Just bad grammar. I have to use bad grammar. You ain't gotta do nothing.
All right. So there are two things from Evan that I wanted to make sure I hit.
Yeah.
So the first one, maybe we may not explore for very long. The last point he said was he has an 8-foot penis. So, oh. Did that come about because of the scene in Neighbors? That for those who haven't seen the film,
I don't know where that came from. I genuinely don't know where. It may be a thing he may have said to me. I never thought I would have to clear that rumor up. It's not that long. That's uncomfortable. That's the other direction of like, when what girl's gonna want to sleep with me?
When you have to coil it around your waist, like
just
a belt.
Sounds cumbersome.
Okay, I think you probably didn't expect me to bring that up on the podcast, but I had to.
I'm trying, and watch, it's gonna hit me like in the car later. I'm like, oh wait, oh that's what he meant by that. I wondered if it's something else.
We can do a postscript.
Yeah, exactly.
Can have it run on the credits. All right, so the point that I think we might be able to unpack a little bit more is he's mentioned that, and you talked about the newspaper earlier. And I guess it was Kwame, is that his name?
Yeah, yep.
Who got you reading the paper. That you can read something, say, in the newspaper, and then use it somehow on stage that night. And what helps you to do that? Or how do you
kind of
think?
Being in tune with your feelings, you know, and your thoughts, and how, and your true feelings. Like, I will say, a lot of times I'll be able to, like, say a joke the first time and it's kind of a finished product. You know, like I'll say there was a thing that was like online of just me talking about Chick-fil-A. That was virtually my first time doing that joke. I think I like maybe mentioned it the night before, but it was like the first time it just sounds like a finished product because it's like, oh no, I know how I feel about this. I know what I want to say and the points I want to hit. And then you say it and then that's it. So I think it is just like kind of being in tune. If you're in tune, things come out a little bit, you know, easier.
Do you, is there anything in your creative process for developing material that is unusual when you describe it to other stand-up comedians or other people?
It's a good question. I mean, I wonder what's unusual about it. Because there, I mean, I think I ignore a lot of things that people don't like, meaning like industry stuff and, you know, like things that I think things that matter to a lot of comedians don't necessarily matter to me. Or I realize that focusing, it's kind of going back to what we said earlier, like focusing on just myself and the work gets that thing that, you know, so I think I ignore more things than like a lot of comedians.
Have you, what helps you to do that? Do you say anything to yourself in particular? Is that just hardwiring?
Yeah, I mean, it's both emotional and logical to me. Like, you know, emotionally, it's just like, well, if I don't think that I can, if I don't think this is meaningful, then I'll cut it out of my life. And logically, if you look at history, you'll see the things that fall out and you'll see, you can read this. That's why I like reading biography. You see, you read about people's mistakes and read about the things that ultimately didn't matter. So it's like, I don't want to focus any energy on anything that doesn't matter or won't matter.
Right.
Yeah.
The distractions of life.
Yeah. The distractions of life. Yeah. I mean, that's probably why I'm not like, and it also that is a personal thing. Cause it, for instance, there, we were talking about like social media, right? And certain people are great and a source of, you know, inspiration and a source of like great content on social media. For me, it doesn't contribute to my life in a meaningful way, so I don't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a left turn, but all of these are left turns. So I guess we're just going in a square kind of counterclockwise. Anyway, what purchase of say less than $100, but just any purchase really is fine, that has had the most positive impact on your life in recent memory?
Probably ever, like a notebook.
Notebook.
A notebook and pens, like just write, and I don't even write out jokes, but I write out thoughts.
What
you know,
type of notebook?
Goals and thoughts.
Goals and thoughts.
Yeah.
What, do you have a particular type of notebook that you like?
I mean, my grandma would get me some for like Christmas, these little small pocket size one, the little, but really any notebook will do. Just yeah. Any like notebook. That and the bolognese at John and Vinny's are the two most impactful.
The bolognese at John and Vinny's.
Yeah, the bolognese at John and Vinny's and notebooks.
What types of thoughts do you write down? Because we all have a million plus thoughts a day. What types of things do you write down?
Really anything that sticks out, how I feel about people, how I feel about me. What I want, what I just like anything that's like worth just kind of journaling essentially.
It seems to have a strong, it seems to tie back a lot to what you were mentioning earlier, which is your emotional response to different things.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what my emotional response, it's like capture. I want to know because you see it. If you look at it and if you write down a goal, like you have this image now in your head. It's not just this floating thought. It's an image that you have in your head.
What types of goals would you write down?
I'll write down really like general and like specific things.
Can you give any examples?
Like, I mean, for instance, like
present?
Really the two first career goals I remember, I wrote down that I wanted my first time doing stand-up on television to be HBO, and I wanted a show on NBC. I remember writing like that. Those are very broad goals, but I wrote down specifically like the HBO thing. And actually, as I was like just doing stand up and going over like old thoughts, like preparing for the first special, I actually grabbed an old notebook, the one I didn't realize I'd written it in, and the night before we taped, and I kind of like opened it and I just turned the page, and there it was, like the goal, like HBO special.
Now, did you write it down once and then it was embedded for years?
It's there. I can still tell you exactly how it was written on a page. It's like I skipped a few lines. HBO was written in big letters. And then I wrote like you know, just a couple sentences about how I wanted to look and feel. Documentary is written down. So I wanted it to be a documentary and like specific like ideas about it. Same thing for the next. We just did I just taped another special and same thing. Same pay. I like the word invasive.
Invasive.
It's written down invasive. I wanted it invasive. I wanted it emotionally honest. I wanted it to go past just jokes. And I didn't want to just tell you jokes, you know, and I wanted it just to be real and, you know, exploration, like these certain words that I think, you know, was captured. I mean, Bold directed and it's like really, I think he's brilliant and he captured it so perfectly. But yeah, these really personal things.
Well, I think you are one of the most, honest and dangerous in the best way possible comedians out there today.
Thank you very much.
I really enjoy your work. Do you have any parting thoughts, comments, requests of the people listening? And then I'll ask you where people can find you and everything you're up to.
No, I mean, no. Try the bolognese at John Finney's.
Try the bolognese. And then I'm going to try, and I'd recommend people try the face at the top of the well exercise.
Oh,
I like that.
That's perfect. You plugged it for me.
My job.
I really want to see if I created it or stole it from someone. I genuinely don't know.
I'm sure someone out there will be like,
no, I was doing face at the top of wealth for 30 years. Like someone's going to say it or something. Yeah, I don't know.
We can find out
it's like in the Tao Te Ching.
It might be. Yeah. You know, I mean, everything that is old is once new again. This has been a lot of fun, man. I really
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
This is awesome, man.
Yeah, and what a great environment. All sorts of weirdness. We have a wooden horse to the left of us.
Yeah, it is. A horse. It's like a retired merry-go-round horse. It's like it retired here.
There's a lot happening right now. Yeah. And I want to let you get back to your day. Where can people find you? What you're up to? What can they check out? Where should they start? Anything you want to tell them?
Be around, man. That's kind of the truth.
Yeah.
Maybe loitering outside a movie theater. Probably walking around LA or New York.
Website, social?
Nah.
All right. I'm going to sneak it into the show notes for people interested.
It's there.
They can find you.
Yeah, I'm around.
It's people know how to use around. Google. And if
I'll
you don't,
see you guys.
How the hell did you find this podcast?
Say hi.
All right, guys. I will put links to everything we've talked about in the show notes, as per usual. And you can find those notes, links, as well as every other episode at 4hourworkweek.com/podcast. All spelled out, 4hourworkweek.com/podcast. And until next time, thank you for listening.
Thank you, man.
Thank you, sir.
Fine.
We'll have a round too soon.
Hey guys, this is Tim again. Just a few more things before you take off. Number one, this is Five Bullet Friday. Do you want to get a short email from me? Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides a little morsel of fun before the weekend? And Five Bullet Friday is a very short email where I share the coolest things I've found or that I've been pondering over the week. That could include favorite new albums that I've discovered. It could include gizmos and gadgets and all sorts of weird shit that I've somehow dug up in the world of the esoteric as I do. It could include favorite articles that I've read and that I've shared with my close friends, for instance. And it's very short. It's just a little tiny bite of goodness before you head off for the weekend. So if you want to receive that, check it out. Just go to 4hourworkweek.com. That's 4hourworkweek.com, all spelled out, and just drop in your email and you will get the very next one. And if you sign up, I hope you enjoy it.